The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast Special Edition, December 1st, 2017. It's the Criminal Flynn Formation Day for Lieutenant General Mike Flynn, who pleaded guilty this morning to a single count of false statements to the FBI under 18 U.S.C. 1001 and has agreed to cooperate with Special Counsel Robert Mueller. Following our usual practice, we tore up our days and put together a all-star panel reached by recorded conference call. Susan Hennessy and I are in the Jungle studio, and we have by phone Orrin Kerr of, I think, a few days more of GW Law School before he abandons us for Southern California. Paul Rosenzweig from now the R Street Institute and former a veteran of special counsel or independent counsel investigations. Steve Vladek of the University of Texas and former NSA general counsel and DHS policy guru and the hold record holder for returning to Steptoe and Johnson to practice law the most times, Stuart Baker. Welcome, everybody. So, Orrin, you've been a federal prosecutor. Let's start with an overview from your point of view of what inferences you think it is fair to draw from this plea deal. There's been a huge amount of stuff reported about Mike Flynn, a lot of different crazy stories about him. The matters to which he's pled are relatively discreet false statements issues. What should we conclude from that about what exposure he may have had or what Bob Mueller expects to get from him?
So I think there are two conclusions to draw. One is just procedurally, the door is open now in the Mueller investigation to figuring out what happened. Whatever it was, Flynn is at the center of this, and he's cooperating, and he's spilling the beans, and everybody who's involved in whatever happened now knows that Flynn is spilling the beans, so they're going to want to approach Mueller and see if maybe they can cut a deal too. So this is really the key, it seems to me, this is the biggest news we've had so far of the investigation, of really a breakthrough that allows Mueller and his team to figure out what was going on. So that's just procedurally, I think that's a really big part of this. And then substantively, we learn that at least soon after the election and before Trump actually took office, there was a working relationship between the Trump campaign and the Russian government, in which there were, from what we know now, apparently Kushner was saying, you know, let's contact the Russians, let's work with them over things. And this was, I guess, a month after the election. Well, when did that relationship start, and how broad was that relationship, and what are the origins of that relationship? That's really the big question, and the person who knows that best is probably Flynn, who's now, of course, cooperating with Mueller. So this is a lot of doors opening, pretty big news.
How do you read the fact that the kidnapping plot is not in there. The spread nuclear power plants all over the Middle East is not in there. The substantive FARA violations are not in there. I mean, there's a lot that's been reported about Mike Flynn that's this criminal information and stipulation of fact are quite silent on. How do you read that?
Just a guess, but I gather the point of this public plea is just to let everybody know, hey, Flynn is cooperating, and you better get on board fast, because we're gonna find out what's going on soon if we don't already. So I gather, this is just a guess again, but I would think Mueller's strategy is make sure everybody knows that the door is open without laying their cards on the table. They want to keep this. They just want to let everybody know Mueller's flipped, and it just doesn't matter what else. Flynn has flipped, and it just doesn't matter what else Flynn did. This is just about getting on the table that he's cooperating, and that the investigation is moving on from there.
All right, Paul. So you have you are just one of the few people who speaks publicly on these subjects, who has been in not Bob Mueller's shoes, but in Andrew Weissman's shoes in a high-profile investigation like this. Take us inside your read of what's going on in Mueller's shop over the last few weeks. What do they think they're getting done here?
Well, I think Oren said it right in a broad sense. Flynn is a linchpin to the investigation. He was present at, almost every event of any significance. He is now in a position to both speak to what happened and potentially, presumably, to provide access to documentary evidence that substantiates what he's saying. But to take the most obvious, simple example, the information that we that was filed, the statement of the offense suggests that he called Mar-a-Lago, right? There are phone records of those calls. So he can say who he called, and they can substantiate that now with a lengthy list of phone record details that would substantiate exactly how long they spoke for. Was it a 2-minute call or a 38-minute call? Makes a huge difference as to the inferences you draw as to whether or not it was substantive or simply informative. So one of the things they're doing is lining up everything they know about what Flynn is now going to testify to against everything they know that was happening inside the campaign. The other thing that they're doing is lining that same timeline, now that they have Flynn, up against the things that were happening outside the campaign. The vote in the UN Security Council that was at issue at one point, the other contacts by other people that have been reported with Russian interlocutors, those are all now getting put on a timeline that in the end will paint a picture. What that picture turns out to be, we don't know yet, but they now have at least one of the people who put a lot of paint on the painting. If you would. And so this is a great start to the investigation. One thing I would say is Oren's also right to say that people now need to think about cooperating, but not everybody gets to come in, right? This is a situation in which a prosecutor says the train is leaving the station. Get on board now or you're going to be left behind. Probably there's only one more high-level person who can get as good a deal as Flynn has gotten. Everybody else who's implicated, if they don't come forward now, they're going to pay a much higher price later down the road.
So the president's lawyer, Ty Cobb, released a statement this morning that, again, reminded me a little bit of Saddam Hussein's spokesman during the Iraq War, who, as U.S. troops are rolling into Baghdad, is giving these press conferences about how the invading forces are being routed on every front. But he issued a statement that said that this, you know, implicates nobody but Flynn, and is another sign that Mueller is proceeding in a, you know, responsible fashion, and that this should all be wrapped up very quickly. And I'm wondering if there's any reason in either of your judgment not to see that as either spin or delusional thinking, but to take it seriously as a judgment of where things are headed and how we should understand this.
Well, I don't think that Ty Cobb is delusional, but it's not great spin. This case is not going to be over for a good long while. First, they have to corroborate everything that Flynn says to them and make a determination about that. And then, as I think I've said before on these podcasts, this case isn't going to end until Mueller also gets a chance to talk to Manafort and get his testimony. And right now, that's not available to him. It would be only after either a plea agreement or a conviction and compelled testimony. So if Manafort plays this game out for another 8 to 12 to 16 months, we may be here a long while.
Here, I mean, this is actually the moment when the Mueller campaign is sort of, you know, or the Mueller investigation has the most information that it's gaining, and it's gaining speed and is likely gathering new information. This is not something that's about to wrap up or doesn't go beyond Flynn.
Yeah, so look, but the one thing I'm struck by is, so, right, sort of take Ty Cobb at his, you know, at face value, right? So believe Ty Cobb for a minute. This isn't going to touch the president. This isn't going to go any further. It's just about Mike Flynn. That means that Mueller, despite the astonishing range of information about sort of possible exposure that Flynn might have, Mueller allowed Flynn to cop a deal that essentially involves like 6 months jail time, a $10,000 fine, right? Really lets the guy off with almost nothing, sort of a wrist slap on a really serious offense by a sitting U.S. official, sort of an issue of public integrity. I think even, you know, you don't have to know what's coming next to sort of get that that's a fundamental mismatch. You wouldn't be seeing this kind of a deal if it wasn't, you know, just kind of the tip of the iceberg, if Flynn wasn't giving them a lot of information and about people that are much higher up the chain than him.
Okay, so let me throw this open to anybody who has a theory of the answer to this question. I find mystifying Section 3 additional charges in the plea agreement. Section 3 reads in its entirety, in consideration of your client's guilty plea to the above offense, your client will not be further prosecuted criminally by this office for the conduct set forth in the attached statement of the offense. Now, the obvious inference from that is that he remains vulnerable to charges for conduct not set forth in the statement of the offense, which is limited to these false statements matters. And so my question to anybody who has a theory about the answer to that, to this, is, does this imply that there's going to be a separate plea agreement to resolve other matters, or does this imply that Flynn remains vulnerable to the non-false statements charges that he may have exposure on if Mueller chooses to come down hard on him later on?
That's reasonably standard. They wouldn't promise to not prosecute him for everything else because they don't know what the everything else is. The non-pros for the other stuff is kind of implicit with his cooperation, in the same way that the plea agreement doesn't mention the fact that there'll be no charges against Mike Flynn Jr. But you have to kind of assume at this point that that was part of the deal, otherwise Flynn wouldn't have taken it.
So, Paul, is that your way of saying you think that, you know, if Mueller substantiates these allegations related to Gulen, that's got nothing to do with this, and they might go ahead and still, you know, prosecute Flynn on really serious charges?
Well, if I were Flynn and I thought that were a realistic possibility, I wouldn't have come in, right? I mean, that's the inference we take from this, is that it's implicitly that they're not going to continue that investigation that much further.
All right. So let's bring in Steve and Stuart. Guys, what were your impressions on reading these documents today?
So I'll start. I cannot get past the question of why Flynn would have lied here. And there's an implication that there were other people who wanted to mislead the public about these calls. But I'm having trouble finding the crime that's being covered up. I don't take seriously the Logan Act. I don't think that there's an impropriety in somebody who's less than a month from the presidency wanting to make sure that the outgoing president doesn't leave him a stinking pile of garbage on his front stoop. And so all of these contacts could have been justified politically, criminally, legally. So I don't quite understand why Flynn would lie or be instructed to lie about them to the vice president or to the FBI.
So, Stuart, here's my theory, and I'm interested in whether or not you think this actually responds to that. So I completely agree there's no legal issue here, Logan Act or otherwise. That said, look, this was, the implementation of sanctions, at the end of 2016, that had bipartisan support. Republicans were criticizing Obama for actually not doing enough. This really was the Trump administration acting in a way that was out of line with not just the Obama administration foreign policy, but everybody. So you really think politically, if they had just stood up and said, hey, this is our policy and this is what we're going to be pursuing, they wouldn't have paid a price for that?
Well, so if they said we're going to get rid of them, they would have had trouble politically. If they said to the Russians, listen, don't react. Give us some time to think about this. Let's see if, it's the equivalent of selling Putin a reset button. That's a good deal.
I mean, that's interesting, Stuart, because I think if they would have been maybe okay if they'd just said it publicly, right? If Trump had gotten up and said in public, I want to have a good relationship with Russia, and I hope everybody acts with restraint so that when the new administration comes in, we can make our own policy. I think nobody would have thought that was an impropriety. There's something about getting on the phone with the ambassador in secret and passing a message and then lying about it that creates an impropriety, right?
It's the lying about it that I don't understand. Somebody thought it was damaging.
Yeah, but Stuart, politicians lie for the strangest reasons. Now, we always thought that the thing Bill Clinton should have done would have gotten up the first day and said, yeah, I did it. Hillary doesn't care. Why should you? And just moved on, right? They lie because they think that the perception of what they've done will be bad, and they don't want people to have that perception. Trump had been under the gun for his pro-Russianness, so they lied because they didn't want people to think they were pro-Russia.
Yeah. Then you have trouble figuring out whether there's some crime that they're obstructing the investigation of.
Steve, what are your thoughts? You saw the you read the docs, and what jumped out at you?
So I think the most extraordinary passage in any of the documents that came out today is paragraph 4 of the statement of offense. Which is actually not about Russia. Well, it's indirectly about Russia. It's about sort of coordinating with Russia to defeat a UN Security Council resolution on the issue of Israeli settlements. I think this really illustrates part of the disconnect in the conversation that we're having. Paragraph 4 of the statement of offense defines to me a textbook violation of the Logan Act, even though I think no one in their right mind would ever bring a Logan Act prosecution at all, let alone in a case like this one. Right? It's not necessarily settled that someone like Flynn wasn't acting with the authority of the United States, although I think there's a decent argument. There are First Amendment objections. But let's sort of drop the legalities for a second and talk about what paragraph 4 actually says. Paragraph 4 says that Michael Flynn coordinated with the Russian government to defeat a Security Council resolution that the then U.S. government was supporting and trying to get the Security Council to adopt, right? So, you know, Stewart and Paul wonder, you know, why not just come out and admit what you're doing? Well, okay, so if Donald Trump had gone on national television on December 21st, 2016, and said he was working behind the scenes to defeat a Security Council resolution, you know, about Israeli settlements, how do we think people would have reacted to that? I mean, I think there's a reason, and it's not just the instinct of politicians, why this was all done under the table, through back channels, et cetera. And, you know, I think we have to be careful not to get lost in the legal formalities of why this would have been such a, you know, popularly problematic thing, and why the instinct of everyone from 3 days into the administration was to insist that it never happened.
Am I right that this was an abstention, not this was the U.S. abstaining, not promoting the resolution, and that there was a reason the U.S. had was abstaining after the election was over, because it wasn't politically popular to support resolutions that attacked the administration of the occupied territories. I'm not sure that there was a political price to be paid here, or that this was, I think the most interesting thing is that anyone would have thought that the Russians would ever vote against this. That strikes me as naive.
Separate from the naivete of the Trump folks, I mean, you really think there would have been no eyebrows raised and no serious concerns about the judgment of an incoming administration that had insisted for months it had no contact with the Russians, if it came out that they were talking to the Russians about defeating a Security Council resolution from which the United States was otherwise abstaining, which of course would not have defeated the resolution?
I think they made clear that they thought that that was the wrong thing for the president to be doing. So, you know,
actively soliciting the Russians to defeat it?
Well, that just makes them look naive. I'm not sure that. I am quite confident that United States government and the president, whenever something comes to the UN Security Council that they care about, calls every government in sight and colludes with them or tries to get them on side, including the Russians. So there's nothing wrong with the president doing it. If you think that somebody who's going to be president in 3 or 4 weeks shouldn't do it, I think it's a little naive on your part.
Okay, so I want to go back to Stewart's original question, which is why lie about this? And, you know, we've just had an interesting discussion about why lie on it. But one of Stewart's underlying points was that the underlying activity, unless you take the Logan Act seriously, is not apparently criminal, right? And so what are they trying to cover up? And so I want to turn that question around and say, is the significance of this plea agreement what it says about this set of activities, this set of incidents, or is it what Flynn will presumably be able to testify about other matters?
I think this is the opening of the door to what else Flynn knows, and a signaling that Flynn has flipped, and the details of the facts that were revealed today is just kind of a hint of what else Flynn knows. I don't think that's the significant part.
Okay, so if that's the case, then why does it matter why they were lying about this? The only fact that matters is that they were lying, that Flynn got caught, and that then opens a door, right, Oren?
Well, I think, you know, the fact that they were lying raises the possibility that they were lying to cover up the other part of the picture that we haven't seen yet, right? So at this point, we're all dealing with inferences and maybes and guesses. But, you know, I lied about fact one because I don't want you to learn fact two is a pretty logical series of events. So maybe that's the bigger picture that Mueller is now learning about, and that's what we really care about, and that's coming too.
Yeah, so I certainly think this gets to the question of what else is there. And I think that's sort of inherent in all plea agreements, right? That he's cooperating because he has some form of substantial assistance to offer. I do think that the lying question, though, it's not just one of sort of the legal technicality of, you know, well, he violated 1001. And it's also who else might have violated 1001 and who else can now be proven to have violated 1001 based on the cooperation that Flynn is about to provide. It's also, you know, it's offering additional nuance to two different buckets. You know, one is, look, the vice president of the United States, or the then vice president elect of the United States, went on national television and said General Flynn did not discuss sanctions. Now, it was, and then the White House essentially represented that, well, Flynn lied to Pence. And so Flynn is going to be held accountable and he's going to be fired because he lied to Pence and that caused Pence to lie to the American people, or to misrepresent the facts to the American people. Now we have a sworn statement that says no, there was at least one and potentially multiple very senior Trump officials who knew full well that Pence was not telling the truth to the American people, and apparently were perfectly happy with that up until the Washington Post revealed that wasn't true. That's a whole other set of issues about sort of serious political accountability. The other question is, look, now that we have this set of information and we wind back the clock and we think about the pattern of activity that we've sort of talked about in connection to the obstruction of justice investigation. You know, why did he have these various contacts with Comey, with Admiral Rogers, with Coates, with Burr, with all of these different people? You know, there's always sort of been this question of, can the course of conduct amount to obstruction, even if an individual instance doesn't. The question is whether or not this new information provided in the indictment, which really is, people in the Trump world were intimately connected to this and potentially had their own exposure to this. Does that change the way we should be thinking about these interactions to say, well, there wasn't really evidence of corrupt intent before, but now that we have this piece of the puzzle, that's starting to look more likely?
So, Stuart, you are the person whom I have the highest regard for, who thinks the Trump-Russia stuff is pretty overblown. I know a number of people who believe that, but you're the one who believes that, for whom I would lie down in traffic and think the absolute world of. And so my question is, does bringing this inside the White House in the form of Mike Flynn lying about his interactions with the Russians change at all your sense of the Gestalt picture here?
It does to a degree. I mean, I can't tell what else there is that Flynn might testify about. It's possible that he got a pretty good deal here because he had a whole bunch of other stuff that isn't showing up yet. And it's also possible that some of those other things that have been reported don't turn out to be as easy to prosecute as you might think, like, inchoate conspiracies and the like. So I can't tell which of those it is. Or maybe Ty Cobb is onto something and he thinks that Mueller believes that it's bad for the country for this investigation to hang around. And he is moving as fast as he can and taking what he can get easily, rather than spending a year on the kidnapping of Gulen. So I can't tell about any of those things. But yes, I'm troubled by the suggestion that all of these calls were approved by others in the transition team, and really, there's not a lot of people who could have done that. Maybe Jared Kushner, maybe the president. Apparently not Mike Pence, and that he then turned around and lied about it. It seems pretty clear that somebody else knew he was lying. And there's a possibility that one of those folks is also exposed, maybe both of them, on this question. And that's not a good thing. It doesn't shed much light on the election. I continue to have my doubts that there was an impact or an intentional deal or a conspiracy or even a tacit understanding with the Russians about the election. But this is bad behavior in the White House for sure.
Steve, I'm interested in your sense of how pardon-proof this agreement is. We have an agreement. It's binding whether or not there's a pardon, right? And to the extent that the agreement is violated, presumably other things can be charged. So what now happens if the president decides to try to make as much of this go away as possible by pardoning Mike Flynn?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we get to an open question about the legal consequences of how a pardon interacts with a plea agreement. I think there's no question in my mind that if the president tries to pardon Flynn for the offense to which he pled guilty this morning, that the special counsel will then proffer additional charges against Flynn, including the ones that are described in the charging document. And then I think the question is, well, would the president also then seek to pardon Flynn for those charges as well? And I guess I just have to think and frankly hope that at some point down that pardon slope, congressional Republicans are awakened from their torpor and decide that enough is enough. At the end of the day, you know, the pardon power, I think, would effectively allow the president to thwart Flynn being indicted by the special counsel, at least. You know, whether you might see someone like the New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman go after Flynn in a context that wouldn't be pardonable, separate issue. Of course, the flip side is, if Flynn is pardoned, presumably Mueller can still hold him to the cooperation elements of the agreement. Not only that, though, Ben, right? But if Flynn is pardoned, then he also presumably loses any sort of Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination to not answer questions about the offense for which he's been pardoned.
And moreover, he has proffered presumably certain testimony that he's prepared to give. And if he doesn't testify in a fashion consistent with that proffer, he can presumably be prosecuted for perjury. Right.
So prosecuted for perjury.
No,
and then we're back
no,
to our
Ben, because. Yeah, the proffer can't be used generally against you in that sort of way. I think actually the thing I would add to this is Flynn can't be expecting a pardon, because if he were expecting a pardon, he'd never have pled, right? He'd have hung out and waited for the president to come to his rescue.
Right, but the president is a mercurial individual who might at any time pardon somebody in a fit of pique and or fire Bob Mueller in a fit of pique. And so I think the fact that Flynn is acting rationally doesn't necessarily mean we should presume that the president will, right?
I mean, Ben, listen, I think there are three ways this story ends, right? The story ends the way that Andrew McCarthy is, I think, quite naively suggesting, which is that this is it, that all of this effort and all of this money and all of these lawyers have spent all of this time investigating four people, and that the dominoes stop falling after today. Right? Version number two is this keeps going, right, until it gets so close to the president that whether it compels the president's demise politically or legally, one of those two things happens, right? And possibility number three is somewhere between point A and point B, the president pulls out some of his heavy hitters and heavy guns, whether it's pardoning, whether it's going after the Mueller investigation directly, and then we're left where I think we were always going to be left, which is in a showdown between congressional Republicans and the president. And, you know, I think all that's happened today is to suggest that we are increasingly gaining speed on the track toward one of those things coming true.
All right, so let's wrap this up with a lightning round. Oren has dropped off, so he's been struck by lightning. In whatever order you guys like, let's start with you, Steve. Final thoughts. What happens next?
I think what happens next is a whole lot of speculation and noise. But as with, for example, the twin sort of barrels of the Manafort Gates and Papadopoulos news, the real question is, what is the next shoe to drop? Or more to the point, on whom is the next shoe going to drop? I think we've already seen suggestions this afternoon that the unnamed senior transition official who looks to be in a lot of trouble under the charging documents is Jared Kushner. So is Mueller now going to move against Kushner? But, you know, Ben, again, I think the real question is not what does Mueller do next. I think the real question is at what point we really start to see some movement by congressional Republicans to actually maybe ramp up their own investigations, right, or to, you know, throw increasing support behind Mueller's investigation. I think that's going to have a lot to say about the next steps thereafter.
Stuart, what happens next?
Oh, I think, there aren't a lot of dominoes left on the board if you're trying to move up the chain. So I wouldn't want to be Jared Kushner. Unlike Steve, I do not expect anybody in Congress to rise up because either Flynn or, frankly, Kushner ends up in some kind of perjury problem.
Paul, what happens next?
Well, I'll go off in a different direction just to be provocative. The next shoe to drop is going to be something to do with money laundering and fraud in the Trump New York real estate empire.
That's a
Utterly unrelated to Flynn, but related to, I think, the locus of where the president is actually much more vulnerable, given what I think I know about how the New York real estate business operates.
Bold prediction from Paul. Susan, what comes next?
Yeah, so I broadly agree with the pivot to Jared theory that he's sort of next in the barrel, as Roger Stone would say. I do think that we've seen this sort of back and forth between the congressional investigations and Mueller, right? So Mueller's special counsel makes a step forward. Then all of a sudden, the congressional investigations start to get their act together. You know, I think the wild card here is that, you know, we've seen Trump. He's had a pretty erratic week, even for Trump. And so I think that we shouldn't discount his capacity to frankly do something kind of nuts here that really might change things, something like issuing a pardon, something like making sort of, you know, wildly inappropriate statements, something like firing Mueller. And so that's the one thing that I think it makes it almost impossible to predict what happens next.
Well, so I am going to go out on a Paul-like limb and make an irresponsible prediction. I think the next thing that's going to happen is a Rick Gates plea on the theory that this will have sent a message to somebody. And as Paul pointed out in a prior podcast, Gates is relatively young and has young children and has more to lose than some of the others. With that, let's wrap it up. Thank you all for joining this call on short notice. And of course, the Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to everybody who's making Lawfare come out on days like this. We don't have music on special edition podcasts, but if we did, it would be performed by Sophia Yan. And if you're listening to the Lawfare podcast on a day like this and you haven't left a rating on iTunes, go do it now so that I don't have to ask you again. And tweet out this episode of the Lawfare podcast. We don't do any advertising. We don't do any, promotions. The only way we get distributed is because of people like you. So share us. And thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.